A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth and Movies. I'm David Jenkins.
I'm Hannah Strong.
And I'm Charles Bromesco.
And we are here all in the same room for once at the 2022 Cannes Film Festival 75th edition. And this week we're going to scrape aside our usual rotation of weekly cinema releases for the UK. And we're actually going to focus, just because we have been at the vanguard of art cinema at the Cannes Film Festival, we're going to talk a little bit about some of the films we've been seeing, because there's a lot of big names and a lot of great movies and a few not so great movies. We want to give you a little panorama of the good, the bad and the ugly. So, Charles, Hannah, I've been here all morning. I've been writing a review, just to give a bit of colour to the listener. I've been writing my review of the new Claire Denis film, which we saw last night, and we'll get onto that a little bit later. But you guys were up and out very early doors this morning to see
Elvis. that was my Elvis.
That was your Elvis impression. Oh, Elvis.
Yeah, both solid.
And you can see why neither of us were cast in the film.
and so the thing about Elvis is I was not present at this screening. It's been the topic of conversation among many press and critics here, because it's been a tough one to get a ticket for. They didn't necessarily give it a big space and a lot many tickets to it. So how did you guys get in?
Through sheer force of will. Every year they've got a couple really, really large American studio films that are set to come out within the next month or two. And I guess this and Top Gun 2 were the really big ones this year. And so I guess there's high demand.
Yeah, I think Top Gun actually did have one more screening, because they did it in the IMAX as well as the Lumiere and the Agnes Varda screens here. But Top Gun was out this week, I think, in the UK and the US and France. Elvis, I'm pretty sure there's another. It was a few weeks ago. I think we might end up doing it in a few weeks on the podcast.
You can't have too much Elvis.
Well, I don't know about that.
Which is an idea that the film itself really puts to the test.
Yeah, no, I booked my ticket when it became available and then had to listen to everyone for 3 days saying, oh my God, why can't I book a ticket to Elvis?
I was one of those people, and I, through really just sheer luck, managed to find one. They keep releasing new tickets in the middle of the afternoon without telling anyone. So you just go randomly check, and then suddenly you relay to all of your friends that, oh look, there are more tickets.
So you both got in, and was the atmosphere electric? Was it like going to see Elvis in the 50s?
Charles, as someone who was there in the 50s.
Yeah, no, as an 87-year-old American man, I would say that this was like if everyone going to see Elvis in Las Vegas was very, very sleepy and tired and a bit shiny with sweat. Right. Which is, I mean, not totally dislike. Yeah, not totally dislike the concerts.
So this is a Baz Luhrmann film,
very much so.
And could you give us your description of what it is and how it works? Is it the Baz Luhrmannized biopic of Elvis?
Well, I think the second it all started to go downhill was when the Warner Brothers logo came on screen and it was like rhinestoned.
The first thing that happens.
Yeah.
The first thing that happens.
No, I was sat next to Charles and our esteemed colleagues and friends, Juan and Mark, and that was the first oh no moment of many oh no moments during the film. You know, this has been like in the works for so long. I think it was always going to be an uphill struggle for Baz Luhrmann to make a movie that didn't suck. And, you know, I will say this, I was not bored, but I did check my watch about 5 times because it's 2 hours 40 and you feel every minute of that. It's there's a lot going on. A lot going on indeed.
And yet for such a long film, it doesn't even cover really everything in his life. It definitely hits all of, you know, the formative beats about him being a young kid and being enraptured by black music like blues and R&B. Rhythm and blues and gospel, that is my mistake. And it goes through that, goes through his meteoric ascent to fame, goes through his, you know, decline. And yet I do feel like there's a lot we don't see. We get maybe 90 seconds of him in Hollywood. We do not see him shit himself to death on the toilet, which is a bit of a disappointment. Really what I came for. But no, I it is quite a lively film. Although it calms down as it goes. The first 20 minutes are, I think, designed to make you seasick. You're whooshing all through Las Vegas. Things are turning upside down. Things are bursting into flame. There's CGI bejeweled kaleidoscopic nonsense. It is a feast for the senses where you eat so much you want to puke.
And because I've seen it described as like a kind of almost 3-hour montage where you don't necessarily... Is there a dramatic arc to it? Is there something that is kind of... Is there a tension that is keeping you
so
engaged?
The skeleton of the film is the relationship between Elvis and his manager, Colonel Tom Parker, portrayed by a nigh-on unrecognizable Tom Hanks, befitted with a fat suit, big fake prosthetic
nose. He looks like the Penguin.
He looks like if the Penguin had grown up in the rural Kentucky neighborhood of Holland.
Right.
which is... an interesting combination of choices for an actor. But yeah, so the whole idea that this is nonstop continuous montage, I'd say is only true for the first half hour. And then it starts to divide itself up into more legible scenes. And whatever structure the film does have, which is to say that it is not indebted to the 3-act structure that makes a movie feel like it is moving along. It just plods and plods and plods. But yeah, it's all about, you know, this manager who was a sort of Svengali type to Elvis and worked him like a dog and tried to take as much of his money as he possibly could. But then always he had this very strange ability to convince him that they were best friends and that he had nothing but his best interests at heart.
Interesting. A success for you,
Hannah? No. I now have given up, I think, on Baz Luhrmann. I've been workshopping a sort of nickname for this film, and I've decided it is going to be Glamadeus. You heard it here first.
Glamadeus.
If anyone steals that, I will see them in court.
So is that to say that Colonel Tom is his Salieri?
Yeah, absolutely. The whole film is about, the framing device is this deathbed confession, basically, in... I have a lot of questions about the way the film ends and how Baz chooses to frame what killed Elvis Presley. But yeah, I mean, you get the sense throughout the film that this guy was fucking horrendous, whether or not that was Baz Luhrmann's intention or not. I do think that Austin Butler is pretty decent as Elvis. You know, it's kind of a thankless role, I think, because ultimately no one is ever gonna be able to portray that level of charisma and talent on screen. It's the same with anyone of that kind of caliber, but I think he works with what he's got. And there are some kind of fun moments. There are a lot of questionable choices. The way it frames like the death of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy, but not John F. Kennedy for some reason, is very, very strange. And it doesn't really get into a lot of the kind of more contentious elements of Elvis's life. Anyway, we'll get back into Elvis in a few weeks. Yeah. So, yeah.
There's plenty of time.
A little
this
taster.
This is just a little taste test of Elvis. So Hannah, what we're going to do for this episode is it's going to be no scores because these are like first look little taster reviews. But we're going to go back and forth and each pick a movie and just talk about it for a bit and why we liked it, why we didn't like it, or and comments from the gang. So, Hannah is going to kick things off. And would you like to introduce your first film?
Yeah, the first film I have chosen is James Gray's Armageddon Time, which is playing in competition and is the semi-fictionalized account of his childhood growing up in New York during the 1980s, which I was excited to see. I like James Gray, and I'm a big fan of Jeremy Strong, who was playing his father in the film, and kind of went in not realizing that this is basically a film about him processing his grandfather's death, which hit me kind of like an emotional freight train, and was a very tough watch. But I really liked it. It's kind of, I think it's been pretty divisive. It's had some kind of glowing reviews, but some people have issues with it, which is, you know, fair enough. I'm a big fan.
It's one of those films that it's kind of strange that it was I think it was the first or second competition film to play in the festival, like over a week ago now. And it feels like decades ago that it happened. I'm always sort of having trouble remembering it, but not to say that I didn't enjoy it as a movie, but it's I think it's very strange seeing these films in the festival cycle.
Well, yeah, you're not meant to watch 30 films in a week. I think I've kind of benefited from taking it maybe a little bit easier this year, because the ticket system meant I missed out on some things I wanted to see, and generally I think there's been a lot of things that I've skipped because the word on the street is that it's not very good. But this was one that, you know, I maybe did benefit from being one of the first films I saw. But yeah, I mean, I'm always kind of a sucker for a filmmaker processing their own trauma. And it's something actually we've seen a lot at the festival. There's a lot of filmmakers kind of reaching back to their childhoods or early marriages, or, you know, processing things that have happened to them. Maybe it's to do with COVID and this kind of urge to reevaluate your life in light of that. But no, I was very impressed with this. The main kid in it who plays the fictional version of James Gray is incredible. There have been some really strong child performances at Cannes, which is not always the case. But yeah, I thought he was great. And I think it's just a very raw film about growing up and realizing that the world is never going to be the place you want it to be, no matter how hard you try. And that's a very depressing thing to realize. But I really appreciate how James Gray's films feel extremely personal and somehow open up into this, you know, kind of thing that I personally relate very much to. And yeah, big fan. And I think maybe one of my favorite film titles of the festival as well.
Nice. And that's named after you had to tell me this.
Yeah, I had to tell everyone this. It is named after the song Armageddon Time, which is a reggae song that was popularized by The Clash, who re-recorded it and plays in the film. And I think it has multiple meanings within the film itself. But yeah, great song. Definitely one of the best needle drops of the festival.
Cool. Okay, let's move on. Charles, give us your choice, which I understand is a little bit different from plush, luxuriant, multi-billion dollar Hollywood autobiog.
Somewhat different. The film, really one of my favorites, along with Armageddon Time, actually, is it's a motion picture documentary called De Corporis Humani Fabrica, Latin for the fabric of the human body. This is a project that comes from what is called the Harvard Sensory Ethnography Lab, which is a documentary filmmaking program at Harvard in the States. And these two directors, Verena Paravel and Lucien Casting Taylor, they make these almost avant-garde, very, very textural documentaries. They made one called Leviathan about deep sea fishing, where you get all these sloshy shots of fish guts in a ship. And this one is set in a number of hospitals around Paris. And it's all about surgery and the goings on at hospitals. And so it is visceral in the most literal sense, in that we are constantly looking at viscera. I guess, yeah, I'll throw you in the way the film throws you in, which is that one of the first things we see is surgery being conducted on an eyeball. You see a very small, I guess, yeah, like a micro scalpel, I don't know what I would call it, jammed right into the nice juicy center part of the eye, and it's sucking little wraith-looking things out of the eyeball, and then it's polishing up the eyeball in a very, very intense way. You see there are these sort of Ludovico-looking metal contraptions keeping the eyelids open, and the person keeps trying to blink when they can't. It is not all that frightening and intense, although there are some rather unspeakable things done to a urethra. But just in terms of, you know, once they're actually inside the body itself, in, you know, intestines, they go through a small intestine, it looks like you're in an alien world. I've seen things that I've never seen before anywhere in any sort of film. And that's really why I go to film festivals. So a friend of mine, this is how he thinks of it. He begins every film festival with the hope that he will see something that he's never seen before. And that is absolutely how I felt about this film.
I had the pleasure of seeing next to you during the screening. And let me add that one of the things that they do in this film, which is really quite a kind of showman element, that almost feels there is a, I mean, it's quite a straight-laced film, but then actually I think that there may be a little bit of humor in the way that they can like edit and conduct these things, where you start off a shot looking at something that you've got that looks very abstract. You sort of don't know where you are in the human body, and it will kind of put the camera, this kind of endoscopic camera that they've kind of produced.
They develop themselves, actually, yeah. Which is pretty incredible.
And then it kind of is pulled through a part of the gut or some artery or something, and then all of a sudden it'll kind of get to a point where you'll suddenly see where you are, and it will be like an eyeball or a penis or something like that. And Charles is slack-jawed.
My reactions were immediate and powerful, yeah. Which is, I think, always a good sign from the cinema. You get these really incredible combinations where you have these close-ups that are so extreme, they're almost just pure texture. It is a very slimy, wondrously slimy movie. But at the same time, we hear the chatter of the surgeons who are working on there. One of my favorite scenes is they're doing an operation, and one of the surgeons wants a fluid to be drained from, I believe, they're working on someone's prostate, and the drainage tubes, the hospital is underfunded and understaffed, and so they've only got one, and then a rather clumsy assistant drops it, and they can't use it, and the surgeon, you know, he bursts into an angry fit. And so, yeah, as much as this is, you know, a fantastic journey to the center of the body, it's also very much about the medical industry in France, and you can extrapolate that to the country of your choosing. One of my favorite shots in the whole thing, we see the way in the hospital that mail is delivered, which is through a pneumatic series of tubes, kind of befitting the subject of the film. And we get this incredible shot where they mount a camera on one of these capsules sent through the tubes, and we just go shooting at like rocket speeds through this. And it's just, it's pure motion. It's pure kinetics. I was amazed.
It is like something from 2001 or Christopher Nolan movie.
Yeah, like, yeah. I mean, it's the sort of thing that if I was the entertaining type, you put this on in the background at a house party and your guests will be enraptured. That's my kind of party. Those are my homemaking tips for entertaining guests.
Excellent. Yeah, I too was a big fan of that one.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Okay, so we're going to move on, and I'm going to now pick a film. One that we promised last week that we would discuss, and that is David Cronenberg's Crime to the Future, his second film with that title. His second and best, I would probably hazard, because the first one wasn't great.
The first one was very early in his career.
Yes. Yeah. So this is like, top and tail end versions of Crime to the Future. It's different film. I think with this film, people approached it with a certain level of expectation that it was going to be a kind of big, juicy genre film.
You can say my name. I expected that.
I think you and me both actually. And I think within sort of half an hour, it's kind of evident that David Cronenberg is not playing your game, and he's playing his very unique individual game. The film is about a future in which human evolution has reached a point where people are suddenly developing new organs, new ways of adapting to the environment. A small child is seen in the first scene eating a plastic bin because he's developed the internal organs to be able to digest and take nourishment from plastic, which Cronenberg sees as something that's going to happen in the future.
You should add as well, people can't feel pain in this future.
Yes. In addition to that. It's a kind of piece of speculative fiction where you have all these rules that he lays out in the first half an hour of how humanity exists now. And he's essentially giving this quite random block of time in which the key characters played by Viggo Mortensen and Lea Seydoux, who are a pair of neo-future performance artists. Viggo, one of the side effects of his new ability to develop new organs is that he gets very cold, so he walks around the entire film in, I want to call it a slanket.
A snuggie.
Something like that. It's got, with a cowl too, though. Yeah. It covers almost everything.
Yeah.
Equal parts burka and snuggie.
Yeah. He's sort of tucked up for a lot of the film.
I missed that he gets cold and that's why he's wearing it. I thought it was like a sartorial fashion statement.
No,
like,
he mentions that he gets cold.
Oh. I missed that completely.
I guess the sort of beginning of the film, it shows that Seydoux and Watson are doing these like performance art pieces where they essentially kind of dissect one another or cut one another. There's lots of knife play, and the suggestion is that in this future, very Cronenbergian, like harking back to things like Crash, is that, you know, people get sexual kicks from being stabbed with knives and being cut with scalpels.
It's all just penetration.
And yeah, it's penetration of a different form. My take on this film is I was completely disarmed by it, and it pulls no punches, and it doesn't necessarily give you any instant gratification. It's very kind of intellectually rigorous and playful and provocative. It's more talky than the initial trailers might have expected. It's very kind of, there's a lot of discourse in it, and often the discourse is very funny and ironic, but I think couched in quite a lot of seriousness.
K-Stew's
in it. She's wonderful.
She's there.
She's doing
present.
A very interesting kind of jittery performance as someone who is enthralled to Viggo's artist. One other thing to add is that because of his abilities, he is invited to be a part of a inner beauty pageant, which unfortunately we never see. But
That was a big cold cock tease from Cronenberg.
Well, I thought the boys' dissection was part of that.
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
Hannah, I'm going to give you like a minute to respond on this because I know that you weren't as hot on this as some other people.
Yeah, and I'm sure whenever it gets a UK release, we'll get into it properly. I do think a good version of this film exists. I just don't think it's the one that we watched. Terrible CGI / practical effects, which is not something I would expect from Cronenberg. He said on the red carpet he'd had this script for 20 years, and it really feels like it, because some of the stuff in this film, I was talking to a friend about this last night at dinner, and the thing is, I think that medical advancement, as relayed to me via you and Charles talking about corpore humani fabrica, has actually moved past the point that Cronenberg's film is at. So I think that he needed to kind of maybe push it further. And it ends at a very strange point. I'm not going to spoil how it ends, but the point at which it ended is where I think I was expecting the kind of, you know, down the rabbit hole third act, which we don't really get. It just felt like the money ran out. But, you know, I'm more than willing to give him a pass. There is another one in the pipeline. And with Cronenberg, it's always like, okay, well, you know, if this wasn't for you, there's another one out there. So, you know, I'm not mad at him or anything, which I'm sure he'll be thrilled to hear.
Right, let's jump very swiftly onto your next choice, Hannah, which is probably one of the most high-profile and films that the press certainly most excited about seeing, which is...
This is Park Chan-wook's long-awaited return to filmmaking, Decision to Leave. It's been a while. It's been a hot minute. I think The Handmaiden was his last one.
He did a TV.
Well, yeah, that doesn't count as TV.
Well, I beg to differ because I thought he did the little jump.
Yeah, it's very good. It's very good. Good Shannon action in that, and good Florence Pugh action. No, it is good, but it isn't a film. And I was very excited. The only thing we knew going in was murder, mystery, romance, boy, howdy, does it deliver on that promise. I loved this film. I know that I maybe am not in the majority. I think there was a lot of kind of dissenting opinions, a lot of people saying, oh, it's not, you know, it's not his best work. So it's the story of this police detective, and he is dispatched to investigate the apparent accidental death of this businessman, and he becomes acquainted with his widow, who is a very charming, very cold, effortlessly stylish. She works in a care home as like a home help nurse, and it's the story of their kind of romantic entanglement. And yeah, very in the mood for love, a little bit of vertigo, all my faves. I think that Tang Wei, who plays Xiao Rei, who is the female lead, is remarkable and is my pick for best actress at the festival.
No, you know, as a response to someone who was a little bit cooler on it, I must say I have had quite a few interesting conversations. It's one of the films I've talked about with people the most because it's got this very, very, in very kind of Park Chan-wook style, it's got this very sort of labyrinthine plot that develops over these various acts, and there's almost a kind of repetition to some of it as well, where he's going through these different motions and seeing like variations on it. And I'm still a bit baffled as to some of the stuff that happened, but I'm intrigued enough to want to discuss the whys. For this kind of murder mystery film, he leaves things quite open.
Oh yeah, it's very ambiguous, and there's a lot of like very clever use of mobile phones, which is not something I'm often able to say about technology on film. Some like gorgeous camera work where you're kind of inside the phone or you're inside this corpse looking at ants kind of crawling over eyes. And Park brings a lot of his kind of regular team back, but the cinematographer on this one is actually someone I'd never heard of, who's called Kim Ji-yong, who I believe is quite a big deal in Korea, but this is their most high-profile project. And it is like, I mean, even the people that don't like the film, I think, would be hard-pressed to not say how stunning it looks. It's incredibly beautiful.
It's a stylish package.
Lots of contrast between the ocean and the mountains, which is a kind of through line throughout the film. And yeah, I cannot wait to see this again. And Rare for the UK, it's one that actually will definitely be coming out, because Mubi have got this worldwide, I believe. I think it's their
It's their biggest US release yet.
Their big coup. Big coup of the festival. But yeah, no, I can't wait to see it again. I can't wait to talk to people about it. I think it's, yeah, just such a beautiful, sad, strange film. And yeah, it feels like I'm wearing a Benedetta t-shirt or recording this as well, and it's a little bit embarrassing at this point, but I can't help it. Like, maybe just keep doing bangers. So, you know, but yeah, that's my big recommendation at the festival.
Excellent. Charles, both of your selections have been taken from this year's Director's Fortnight.
Yeah, that's kind of been a running theme with what I've seen this year. So for those of you who don't know, at Cannes, you know, the biggest movies are put into the competition section. That is where they give the awards. And then sort of lower profile films are put in sidebar sections, such as the Director's Fortnight or Critics Week or Un Certain Regard. And this year, I've enjoyed things that I have seen in the Director's Fortnight almost more than a competition, which is very unusual. And one of those films is a lovely Portuguese picture called Fogo Fatuo, the English language title being Will o' the Wisp, which is a tree that figures prominently into the film, and yet not so prominent as penises, which are really the entree here. 67 minutes, which is a real virtue in the mental crunch of the film festival environment. It is a quasi-pornographic musical comedy about a fancy little nobleman who decides he wants to get a taste of the real world. And he sees a news report about a spike in forest fire, so he decides, why not go and be a fireman? Which is really, I didn't realize this until seeing the film, very inherently gay job. You're surrounded by shirtless men with rippling muscular physiques all day long.
Did you not see Titan?
These firefighters are far, far gayer than Titan. For instance, so obviously there are breaks with reality here when our little brace-faced protagonist comes to the, whose name is Alfredo, comes to the firehouse. His initiation is he is quizzed on works of classical art that are enacted by men in either jock straps or just full frontal nudity. Quizzed about, you know, Caravaggio, all the faves. And so the sense of humor, yeah, like that is very erudite, very art, but at the same time, deeply vulgar in a very sporting way, which I enjoy.
And do you think it's the kind of film that's probably going to be picked up, is going to be shown widely? or is this one of those films that you think people are going to have to look out for on the festival trail?
Well, so the director, whose name is João Pedro Rodrigues, already has, I think, quite a presence in the world of queer cinema. He made a very well-regarded film called The Ornithologist, Ornithologico, not too long ago, 2018, I think. And so the people who will be most, primed to enjoy this, I think, will be aware of it and will be able to seek it out. But my hope is that, you know, in our streaming besotted world, that it can find a loving home on the internet where people will be able to enjoy it to the fullest extent, which might be illegal in the confines of a movie theater.
Right. I don't think Hannah and I haven't seen this one.
However, I have seen The Jaunty Little Man, because at karaoke last night he turned up and did a song. So
what did he perform?
I can't remember. Oh,
God.
It was a duet with his lady friend. I can't remember. Yeah, it totally slipped my mind, but I was sort of stood, you know, watching, and my friend turned to me and said, "Oh my God, that's the guy from the gay firefighter movie." And I was like, "Oh, yeah." The way he was introducing me was, "Oh yeah, he gets cum in his beard."
He does. There's plenty of cum to go around. It's not a European film festival unless you can utter that sentence at least once.
Well, I think there's quite a nice segue to be had from that.
Not a cumless picture, no. The one we're about to discuss.
So we're moving to a new film by the maestro, Claire Denis. A long-awaited adaptation of the 1986 Denis Johnson novel, The Stars at Noon, which is her second film released this year. the first arrived in February when it came out.
Berlin, I believe, right?
At Berlin, called, in the UK it's called Fire, in the US it's called...
Both Sides of the Blade, which was a kind of point of contention for Madame Denis. She did not want it to be released as Fire.
No.
I think it might be going back to Fire. Going back to Both Sides of the Blade. Well, I think, because she got her way in the US, so I think she get her way here.
Yeah, it seems strange that it would be released with different titles in English-speaking territories, but we'll see. But this film is definitely going to be released as The Stars at Noon. and it's an English language film, which she has done a couple of times. She did Trouble Every Day, which was half in English, and she did High Life 2, which was a sci-fi film, which was fully in English. And now this is her kind of, I guess, again, doing, she sort of goes back and forth between these very small-scale, intense character studies, which Both Sides of the Blade is, to these slightly bigger, more lavish projects, which are kind of, it seems that like the amount of money she can get for these bigger, lavish projects is limited.
Yeah.
So she's essentially kind of, with these projects, she's doing, making the best, plushest film she can with the resources available.
The novel would be a period piece if adapted totally faithfully.
Yeah. So from having read the novel a few years ago, the sense that I got was that, you know, this is the kind of book that I was surprised hadn't been adapted in like the 80s and 90s by some kind of, you know, an Oliver Stone or someone like that, with loads and loads of money, loads of production design, big sets, you know, all that kind of stuff, you know, tens of millions of dollars. And what Claire Denis done with her adaptation is like stripped it to its very core. It's a very... where the book is quite kind of atmospheric and dense and very sort of populated, it's set in Nicaragua in the 80s. She has made a version that's very spare, very, very sort of artistically spare and atmospherically quite kind of neutered. But,
you know, although this isn't one of her character studies, it's boiled down to the main relationship between the two leads, I think.
Yes, yeah. So you have the two leads played by Margaret Qualley and Joe Alwyn, the former being a kind of sex pot press attaché who is kind of trying her luck as a journalist and failing, but with the kind of political heat, she knows that her time there is limited, and she's going to need to kind of get her papers in order and get out until she meets Joe Alwyn's Daniel De Haven at a bar, who is a very English, almost kind of Graham Greene-esque character. He's a businessman who works for an oil company whose presence there is kind of mysterious, and they fall together and they have a very kind of passionate, torrid love affair. And in its essence, it's about like pair trying to escape the country together with various parties coming to prevent that. I think it's a strange film for me. It's maybe not one of her, it doesn't rank in her as one of her like most in her sort of top vintage. It's almost like a genre film that lacks any of the sort of expectations and elements that you would require from genre. Like,
there are no shootouts.
Stuff. There are some deaths in it, but it's all done in a very kind of quiet, hushed way. And it's a film that feels like it should be very tense. The book is extremely tense, when especially in its second half, where you're kind of wondering will or won't it. You know, will this romance survive? And you kind of don't know. And this almost kind of lurches towards something of an inevitable conclusion. I don't think Denis necessarily works her best in English language. Oh no, I mean, I love High Life was amazing. So,
I have some thoughts about this, and that I think the script feels a bit out of place, because whereas High Life was sort of, you know, we were up in space, kind of engaging in fantasy, surreality, this is more grounded in realism, and I think the camera work reflects that, but the script, which is quite stylized and sort of idiomatic, you said almost a bit hard-boiled, I think does not totally jibe with that.
My other criticism is I think that while Quali and Joe Alwyn, really, they kind of give it all they've got, but they just don't feel right in these roles. They feel too young. I mean, they feel like kind of 20-something backpackers who've met on a a romance. And the film actually works on that level, I think, as shorn of all the kind of political context, it works as a kind of really tactile, sort of 20-something romance, but maybe doesn't work beyond that. Just the Joe Alwyn as part of an oil conglomerate.
Well, so that was not her first choice.
Yes.
Right. She wanted to work with
our Pats was...
Patman.
The Patman, yeah.
But you had to go be Patman. Yes. That's why you could do
it. So, I'm stuttering a bit because it's obviously a sad moment for me to not say how much I loved a new Claire Denis film, but I'm going to have to be honest on this one and say it was a bit mid for me. But that said, I'm still definitely keen to see it again and sort of search for more of her kind of interesting idiosyncrasies in there. Just before we go, can I put you on the spot and maybe just like let's give a one sentence rant? Because I've got a few little random things that I love that I want to give a shout out to. So if there's anything like small and random that you'd like to give a shout out to as a kind of like a title for people to take notice of.
To look out for. There was a Korean spy picture called Hunt. I don't think that was discussed in the previous podcast. Very lengthy, hilariously violent, just like 25 people getting blown away with squid packs. It feels like every scene. It's a pretty good time. And as a friend of mine was noting, it's, I think, an odds-on pick for Netflix because it is directed by, I believe, Lee Jong-jae, who is the star of their internet television show Squid Game.
Right.
So that's one to look out for.
My pick would probably be Alice Winokur's new film. It's called Paris Memories. I have a feeling that in French it's not called that, because it's called Paris Revoir, which I don't think would be the translation, maybe.
Yeah, I think possibly. Maybe listeners, you can translate that for us. Paris
Revoir. I'm sure it's much easier to translate than I'm making it, but terrible title. Good film. So when Alice did the introduction, she was saying that her brother was caught up in the Bataclan attacks in Paris in 2015, and he survived, fortunately. And this film was based on the conversations that they had during his recovery about his experience. And so she has made a fictionalized version by... starring Virginia Effria? Virginie Effria, as this woman who is involved in a sort of, I don't want to say unexplained, but it's kind of never, the terrorist attack is never kind of really addressed as to kind of what it is. But it's just about this woman kind of coming to terms with that and trying to recover and process her experience and kind of move on from it. And I was very, very surprised at how touching I found it. And I think Virginie's been doing some good work recently, and she's got more than one film here. But yeah, good movie. Hope people get a chance to watch it.
Virginie gave a phenomenal performance during the opening ceremonies of this very festival. she showed a little leg, she did a musical number, she worked the crowd.
She can do it all.
She's a Renaissance woman.
I want to quickly mention one thing that I've really loved, which was a bit of an unknown quantity in the competition. It's a film called Layla's Brothers by Saeed Roustayi, who is an Iranian filmmaker of similar vintage to Asghar Farhadi, known for Separation and The Salesman, etc., etc. It's this incredible, intricate family fresco. A bit like Elvis, it's 2 hours and 40 minutes, but this one keeps you absolutely hanging by your nails for every single one of them until it comes to this jaw-droppingly moving finale. It's broadly speaking about poverty-stricken family in disintegration and the clash between tradition and the modern, and it's just the script is a piece of art in and of itself, and I hope that it finds a home even due to its like extended length that it could be this year's Drive My Car. So that's my hope. Okay, we're going to sign off now. So thanks very much for tuning in. If you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Next week, we'll be back from Cannes and we'll be moving back to our regular rotation of UK releases. Truth and Movies is hosted this week by me, David Jenkins, and my guests were Charles Bromesco and Hannah Stroll. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Jake Cummings.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.